Welcome to Mortgages Made Easy podcast discussion. Let's discuss MRT 1, Topic 1, with Jenny and Mark.
Welcome along. We're diving into the UK mortgage market today, really breaking down the core ideas for you. If you're studying for your LIBF mortgages qualification, especially Topic 1, well, think of this as your go-to audio guide.
Absolutely. The idea here is to walk you through it step by step, following the structure you see in the Future Trend Financial Training Made Easy Guide. We'll be clarifying the key points from that first section on property and mortgages.
So you can listen along while you study the guide.
Exactly. Reinforce what you're reading. We're starting right at the beginning, setting the scene for how the market is structured, making sure it's all clear for your exam prep.
Okay, great. Let's kick off with the big picture then. Section 1.1 in the guide, the UK view of home ownership. What's the general feeling about owning your own place here?
Well, the guide really highlights that in the UK, owning your home is incredibly desirable. It's almost baked into the culture, isn't it? Seen as vital for long-term security, financial stability.
Or just bricks and mortar then.
Oh, definitely. It's often seen as a natural life goal, a key milestone. And, you know, people often view it as probably the best investment they can make over the long term.
Right. But there's a big but, isn't there? That aspiration meets a tough reality, especially for people trying to get started.
That's the core challenge, yeah. Especially for new entrants, first-time buyers. House prices, well, they've just consistently shot up much faster than average wages for, frankly, decades now.
Creating a real affordability gap.
Precisely. That deposit, plus all the costs involved in buying, it's a huge amount to save. It can take years and years, making that first step onto the ladder incredibly difficult. The dream's still there, but the economics are, hell, tough.
And the market itself. The guide describes it as highly competitive. Has it always been like this?
No, not really. The big shift started back in the 1980s. There were major regulation changes then. Before that, it was mainly building societies doing mortgages.
Okay, so deregulation opened the doors.
It did. Yeah. It let lots of new lenders flood in, big banks, specialist mortgage companies. That really broke the old mold and, you know, sparked intense competition. Everyone wanted a piece of the action.
And it wasn't just the lenders becoming more competitive. Borrowers changed too.
Yeah, that's a key point. Borrowers became much more savvy, more demanding. People now expect to shop around, use comparison sites, really drill down into the details of different deals, the features, the rates, before they commit.
So that pressure from both sides lowering, lenders wanting business, borrowers wanting the best deal, led to the market we see today.
Exactly. A huge range of products, loads of different types of institutions offering mortgages. It's a very dynamic, competitive space now.
Okay, that makes sense. It really sets the scene.
Yeah.
Now, to understand today's market, we absolutely have to look back at a defining moment, the credit crunch of 2007.
Yes, this section is critical. So much of the regulation you're studying now, the rules lenders have to follow, stems directly from this period. It was a massive global event.
And it hit the UK mortgage market hard.
Very hard. Demand just plummeted in early 2008 and stayed low for quite a few years afterwards. And as you said, the rules we have now, the affordability checks, the stress tests, they were brought in specifically because of the problems exposed back then.
So let's nail down the definition first. What exactly is a credit crunch for exam purposes?
Right. A credit crunch is basically a severe financial situation where banks suddenly drastically cut back on lending. It happens because they perceive a huge increase in risk across the system.
And when the lending stops?
The whole economy slows down. Businesses can't get loans. Consumers can't borrow easily. It really puts the brakes on everything.
Okay. So how did we get there? From a property boom in the early 2000s to this complete crisis of confidence, what were the root causes?
It started with, well, a bit too much optimism, perhaps. Yeah. The early 2000s saw this massive property boom, partly because interest rates were really low. It led to this widespread belief that house prices could only go up.
Which sounds dangerous in hindsight.
It was. That confidence led some lenders to relax their standards quite significantly.
Meaning they started lending to riskier borrowers.
Exactly. Mortgages were approved for people who, frankly, might not have qualified before. Maybe they had a poor credit history or income that wasn't totally stable. These high-risk loans became known as subprime mortgages or sometimes near prime.
So loans given to people more likely to default.
Essentially, yes. A higher probability of not being able to make the repayments compared to a standard or prime borrower.
And then there's this key mechanism that poured fuel on the fire, securitization. This seems complex but crucial to understand. Can you break it down?
Right. Securitization. Okay, so imagine a lender has issued lots of mortgages. What they can do is bundle these existing mortgage contracts together. They pool them, then they sell the income stream from that pool, the repayments, to a third party, like an investment fund, for cash up front.
Why would they do that? Get the loans off their books.
Precisely. It takes the loans off their balance sheet. This frees up their capital so they can immediately go and lend more money or borrow more themselves. It's a way to recycle capital quickly.
But the risk goes somewhere.
Ah, yes. That's the critical part. The buyer of this bundle, this securitized package, gets the potential income, the capital, and interest payments from the homeowners. But, and this is key, they also take on all the risk that the homeowners might not pay.
And the problem was what was inside these bundles, particularly in the U.S. market.
Absolutely. Many of these securitized bundles, especially those originating in the U.S., contained a really significant amount of those high-risk subprime loans we just talked about.
So when things started to go wrong,
it unraveled fast. When U.S. interest rates started to rise, many of those subprime borrowers, often on variable rates, couldn't afford the higher payments. Defaults started rising sharply.
Which meant the income stream to those bundles dried up.
Exactly. The value of these complex securities collapsed. Several big U.S. lenders failed, and this triggered a massive loss of confidence.
A systemic breakdown.
Pretty much. Banks slammed the brakes on lending, not just to the subprime sector, but crucially, they became terrified of lending to each other. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew who was holding these toxic assets.
So the interbank market froze.
It did. The rates banks charged each other shot up. Money just stopped flowing. Housing market stalled globally. Credit became scarce even for healthy businesses. Share prices tanked. Yeah. It was a full-blown global crisis.
Now, the UK wasn't quite as exposed to subprime, but we certainly weren't immune. The Northern Rock crisis is the big UK example, isn't it?
That's right. We had tighter controls, generally. But some institutions, and Northern Rock was the prime example, had chased growth very aggressively. They relied heavily on borrowing money in the wholesale markets and using securitization to fund their lending.
So when those markets froze, they were stuck.
They were completely exposed. They couldn't get the short-term funding they needed to operate day to day. That led to them needing emergency support from the Bank of England in September 2007.
And public reaction to that news was dramatic.
It triggered the first run on a major UK bank in over 100 years. People queued outside branches, terrified their savings were at risk. It was unprecedented in modern times.
And the government had to step in.
Ultimately, yes. Despite efforts to find a private buyer, the government nationalized Northern Rock in early 2008. Bradford and Bingley followed later. Globally, governments were forced to inject literally billions into their banking systems to provide liquidity, and central banks slashed interest rates, desperately trying to stimulate lending.
The sheer scale of it is staggering. Okay, so that's the crisis. Let's move into the aftermath. What did the UK mortgage market look like after the crunch? What was the new normal?
Well, the immediate period was one of real weakness. The UK fell into a deep recession. And for your exam, remember that definition. A recession is a significant decline in economic activity, usually defined as a fall in gross domestic product, or GDP, for two consecutive quarters, so 6 months.
And that recession fed into a general lack of confidence.
Absolutely. People were worried about jobs, pay freezes, potential redundancies. That creates huge uncertainty.
Leading to a stagnant housing market.
Yeah. Sellers didn't want to sell at lower prices. Buyers were scared prices might fall further. And crucially, the banks themselves were looking inwards. They were focused on rebuilding their own financial strength, their capital reserves, and were very reluctant to lend money out, either to each other or to home buyers.
So things were pretty stuck. Did the government try to get things moving again?
They did. In 2012, the Bank of England introduced a scheme, the Funding for Lending Scheme, basically offering funds to banks and building societies at cheap rates.
The idea being they'd pass those cheap rates on.
That was the hope, yeah. To encourage them to cut mortgage rates a bit and just generally increase the amount of lending happening. Although it's worth noting that from 2013, the scheme's focus shifted mainly towards supporting lending to small businesses instead.
But beyond specific schemes, the whole approach to lending fundamentally shifted, didn't it? We got much tighter standards.
Hugely significant shift. This is really important. Lenders became far, far more cautious. They started demanding much bigger deposits. Those 95% or even 100% mortgages just vanished for a while. and they applied much stricter tests to check if borrowers could actually afford the repayment.
Meaning it got harder to get a mortgage?
Much harder, especially if you had a smaller deposit, perhaps less disposable income after bills or any kind of blip on your credit record, rejection rates went up.
And this wasn't just lenders being cautious on their own. Regulation locked this in.
Exactly. This cautious approach was formalized and made mandatory by the Mortgage Market Review, or MMR, which came into full effect in 2014.
MMR, that's a key one to know.
Definitely. The MMR forced lenders to apply much stricter affordability calculations. It mandated things like stress testing, checking. You could still afford payments if rates went up significantly, and demanded rigorous proof of income. It was all designed to prevent a repeat of the risky lending scene before the crisis.
So the MMR essentially wrote the lessons of the crunch into the rulebook. Okay, so fast forward a bit. How does the market look today, the contemporary picture? When did things start picking up again?
The recovery was pretty slow, but it started gaining traction around 2013. Confidence gradually returned, lending picked up. By about mid-2014, average UK house prices were actually back to where they were before the crash in 2007.
And since then, the general trend has been upwards.
Generally upwards, yes, but with quite a lot of volatility recently, mainly due to, well, unforeseen global events.
COVID-19 being the major one.
Absolutely. Initially, the lockdowns in 2020 caused a sharp dip in activity. Everything just stopped. But then when things reopened, there was this huge surge in people wanting to move.
And that surge was amplified by government action, wasn't it? The stamp duty holiday.
It really was. Between July 2020 and June 2021, the government temporarily increased the threshold for paying stamp duty land tax, or SDLT.
Which meant big savings for buyers.
Huge savings for many. It acted like pouring petrol on the fire, really. Demand went through the roof, pushing up prices very quickly as buyers rushed to complete before the deadline. Then, as the tax break was phased out, things noticeably cooled off again.
And just as the market absorbed that, another shock hit rising interest rates from late 2021 onwards.
Yes, the Bank of England started raising rates quite aggressively through 2022 and 2023. This was their main tool to combat rapidly rising inflation.
Let's pin down inflation for exam purposes, too.
Good point. Inflation is the rate at which the general level of prices for goods and services is rising, and subsequently, the purchasing power of currency is falling. It's measured by the Consumer Prices Index, the CPI. The bank's job was to get inflation back down towards its target.
And raising rates was the way to do it, but it had a direct impact on mortgages.
A very direct impact. Higher interest rates mean higher borrowing costs. This immediately reduced how much people could afford to borrow, because the monthly payments simply took up more of their disposable income according to the lender's affordability models.
So where are we now with rates?
Well, inflation has come down from its peak and rates have started to level off, maybe even edge down slightly. But, and this is a key takeaway, it's extremely unlikely we'll see those ultra-low interest rates that persisted for much of the period between 2009 and 2021 return anytime soon. The era of very cheap money seems to be over.
Okay, let's shift focus a bit to regional differences. The guide makes a point about London being, well, different.
Yeah, that's important context. London's property market often behaves quite differently to the rest of the UK. It's influenced by international money, unique economic factors. You can't just look at London and assume the whole country is the same.
Although its prices must have a knock-on effect nearby.
Oh, definitely. High London prices ripple out into the commuter belt areas. And you also see other major cities, places like Manchester, Bristol, sometimes having their own mini booms, with price rises well above the national average.
So if it's not just about being near London, what's driving demand outside the big cities now? Why are people moving further out?
It's a mix of things, really. That long-term issue of house prices rising faster than wages is a big driver. People are searching for affordability. There's also just a general shortage of housing supply nationally, especially affordable homes, pushing prices up everywhere.
And the pandemic changed things, too.
Massively. There's definitely an increased desire for more space, gardens, that sort of thing. Plus, the rise of working from home means the daily commute is less of a necessity for many, freeing them up to look in quieter, greener locations where they can potentially afford a much larger property.
Right. That makes sense. This leads us neatly into talking specifically about first-time buyers. The guide calls them vital to the market's health.
They really are the lifeblood. If first-time buyers can't get onto the ladder, then existing homeowners can't sell and move up. The whole chain kind of grinds to a halt.
Their challenges are pretty clear.
Yeah, it's that combination we've touched on. The strict affordability checks brought in by the MMR, constantly rising prices, and the sheer difficulty of saving that huge deposit.
Is it worse in some areas than others?
Oh, definitely. It's particularly tough in London and the Southeast simply because prices are so much higher there. The stats show it too. The number of first-time buyers, which had been rising, took quite a hit in 2022, falling nationally and even in London, suggests the pressures are really biting.
You also mentioned their profile is changing. They're getting older.
Yes, that's a noticeable trend. First-time buyers today are, on average, older than they used to be. This has knock-on effects. It means they're starting their mortgage later in life, so they'll be paying it off much closer to retirement age.
Which limits their options a bit.
It can do. It might affect the mortgage term they can realistically take or the types of repayment options available. They might be pushed towards longer terms just to make the monthly payments manageable.
Given how crucial they are, what's being done to help first-time buyers? Any government support?
There are a few measures in place. Some tax changes have been aimed at making buy-to-let investing less attractive, theoretically freeing up smaller homes. There's also specific stamp duty relief for first-time buyers up to a certain property value.
And rules for new developments.
Yes, planning regulations often require developers to include a certain proportion of affordable housing in new building projects, although defining affordable can be tricky in itself.
Okay, we've covered the history, the current state, the buyers. Now let's dig into the key factors that influence the mortgage market day to day. The guide lists six main ones: interest rates, inflation, the economy, supply and demand, government action, and non-property funding.
Right. These are all interconnected, influencing each other constantly, starting with the most obvious one, interest rates.
Which directly hits people's pockets.
Absolutely. The interest rate determines the cost of the monthly mortgage payment. Simple as that. So it's fundamental to affordability.
And we know the broad strokes. High rates bad, low rates good.
Generally, yes. When rates are high, think back to the 80s, 90s, or more recently, the early 2020s, existing homeowners can struggle. First-time buyers get priced out, and house prices tend to weaken or fall.
And low rates.
Low rates make repayments more affordable. People feel more confident taking on larger mortgages, assuming they pass the affordability checks, of course, which drives up demand and can fuel price rises, potentially a boom.
But it's not always that simple. Low rates don't guarantee rising prices.
No, exactly. That's the caveat. If the economy is in recession or consumer confidence is really low, prices can still fall, even if interest rates are rock bottom. Other factors come into play.
Now, you mentioned earlier there's a difference between the official bank rate and the rates banks use themselves. Can you clarify that?
Yes. Mortgage rates are often talked about in relation to the bank rate that's the main rate set by the Bank of England. But the rates lenders actually charge are more directly influenced by the rates at which they can borrow money themselves, typically the interbank lending rates.
The rate banks charge each other.
Exactly. Historically, that interbank rate would typically be just a tiny bit higher than the bank rate, maybe 10 or 20 basis points.
Basis points, remind us.
Yes. A basis point is 0.01%, so 0.01%. If bank rate was 2%, the interbank rate might normally be 2.1% or 2.2%.
But that gap can widen.
Dramatically. In times of stress, like the credit crunch, banks get nervous about lending to each other, so the premium they charge that gap above the bank rate can shoot up, making funding much more expensive for lenders, even if the official bank rate hasn't changed much.
And the benchmark rate they use now has a specific name.
Yes. Since late 2021, the key benchmark for sterling overnight interbank lending is SONIA, the Sterling Overnight Index Average. It's based on actual transactions, so it's seen as robust and hard to manipulate. It's pretty much a risk-free rate.
So lenders might track SONIA or bank rate, but add their own margin on top.
That's right. And those margins, the difference between the benchmark rate and the rate you actually pay, have generally got wider in recent years. Sometimes significantly wider, maybe up to 3% or more above the bank rate, reflecting the lender's costs and perception of risk.
Okay. Besides the Bank of England's decisions, what else pushes interest rates around?
Several things. The level of government borrowing is one. If the government needs to borrow a lot, it increases demand for money, which can push rates up. Similarly, high levels of individual borrowing, lots of people taking out loans and credit cards can fuel demand and potentially inflation, also putting upward pressure on rates.
And there's the government's overall strategy.
Yes. Monetary policy, that's the broad term for the government's approach to managing interest rates and the money supply to influence the economy. And finally, foreign interest rates matter too. If UK rates are much higher than elsewhere, it can strengthen the pound, which sounds good, but makes UK exports more expensive abroad.
Right, interconnected factors. Okay, second factor, inflation. We defined it, but how does it specifically play out in the property market?
There are kind of two types of inflation relevant here. There's general inflation, the CPI measure, the falling spending power of money, and then there's house price inflation, simply how fast property prices themselves are going up.
And they don't always move together.
Not necessarily. Usually, house price inflation runs hotter than general inflation. But if general inflation gets really high and out of control, the Bank of England will raise interest rates to cool it down, and those higher interest rates will almost certainly dampen house prices.
And the bank has a target for general inflation.
It does. The government sets the bank a target, currently 2% CPI inflation. A little bit of inflation, around 2 to 2.5%, is generally seen as healthy for the economy.
And the Monetary Policy Committee uses rates to steer inflation towards that target.
Exactly. It's their main tool. To reduce inflation, they raise rates, makes borrowing expensive, slows spending, prices ease. To increase inflation, if it's too low, they cut rates, makes borrowing cheaper, encourages spending, prices rise.
So the impact on housing is pretty direct. Higher rates to fight inflation equals slower house price growth or falls.
That's the typical relationship, yes. Prolonged periods of rate rises usually lead to house prices stagnating or falling because affordability gets squeezed. Conversely, rate cuts tend to boost affordability and support price increases.
Okay, factor three. The overall state of the economy. This feels linked to confidence.
Very much so. The housing market thrives on confidence. When the economy is doing well, jobs are secure, wages are rising, things feel stable, people feel confident enough to make huge long-term commitments, like taking out a mortgage.
And when the economy is weak or in recession?
Confidence evaporates. People worry about losing their jobs, uncertainty rises, and they postpone major decisions like buying a house. We saw this even after 2007, despite very low interest rates for years. Lingering worries about debt, jobs, and potential future rate hikes kept a lid on the market for a long time.
And the recent cost of living crisis.
That, coupled with the sharp rate rises, definitely dented consumer confidence significantly from 2022 onwards.
Makes sense. Factor four feels fundamental. Supply and demand.
Absolutely basic economics, but it applies very strongly to property. If you have more buyers chasing fewer properties in a certain area or price bracket, prices will go up. If there's an oversupply of a particular type of property, prices for that type will likely fall.
And this explains regional differences.
Largely, yes. The persistently high prices in London and the Southeast are fundamentally driven by high population density and a chronic shortage of housing relative to the number of people who want or need to live there.
Okay. Factor five. Government action. How does policy directly influence the market?
Governments can have a really significant impact through policy choices. We've mentioned the SDLT relief for first-time buyers. Another big one was the changes made in 2015 regarding mortgage interest tax relief for buy-to-let landlords.
Aimed at cooling the BTL market.
That was the intention, yes. And along similar lines, the introduction of the stamp duty surcharge on second homes.
Right. Let's get the details on that surcharge. It's changed recently.
It has. It came in April 2016, initially at 3%, payable on top of the normal SDLT rate when buying a second property, including buy-to-lets. The key update noted in the guide is that this was increased to 5% in the October 2024 budget, with the change effective from April 2025.
And it applies to the whole price?
Yes. If the property is worth over £40,000 and it's an additional property for the buyer, that surcharge applies to the entire purchase price. It's designed specifically to make investing in multiple properties less attractive financially.
So the overall goal is to level the playing field a bit for first-time buyers.
That's the stated aim, yes. To try and dampen the impact of BTL investment, which some argue drives up prices, and make it slightly easier for first-time buyers to compete.
Okay. And the final factor, influencing the market.
Hmm.
Borrowing for reasons other than buying property.
Right. People don't just take out mortgages to buy houses. Because mortgage debt is secured on property, it usually comes with lower interest rates and longer repayment terms than unsecured loans or credit cards.
Making it attractive for other things, like consolidating debts.
Exactly. It's quite common for people to take out a further advance on their mortgage or even a second mortgage to pay off more expensive debts like credit cards or personal loans. Especially, say, after Christmas.
Now, there's a really important point here for advisors about vulnerability.
Absolutely crucial, yes. This is a definite exam point. Under the FCA rules, borrowers who are taking out or increasing a mortgage specifically for debt consolidation are automatically considered potentially vulnerable customers.
Meaning advisors have a higher duty of care.
Yes. They need to be extra careful in assessing the suitability of the mortgage and ensuring the customer fully understands the implications of securing previously unsecured debts against their home. There's also equity release, using a mortgage to take cash out of the value built up in your home, perhaps for home improvements or other big expenses, particularly when house prices have been rising.
Okay, that covers the key influencing factors. Now we need to look at who actually provides the money. Section 1.6 in the guide. Which types of provider offer mortgage finance?
Right, and again, a bit of history helps here. Before the 1980s deregulation, it was a very segmented market. Building societies were the main players for residential mortgages, serving their members. Banks focused more on commercial lending and other services.
But deregulation changed all that.
Completely blurred the lines. It removed the old restrictions and opened the floodgates for competition.
So let's start with the banks. How do they fit in now?
Banks jumped into the mortgage market enthusiastically after deregulation. They see residential lending as relatively safe and profitable, and it fits well with their large scale. A key strategy for them is cross-selling.
Trying to sell other products alongside the mortgage.
Exactly. Insurance, current accounts, credit cards, investments. The mortgage application is a prime opportunity for them to sell their other services to existing customers. And their size gives them advantages. They can raise funds relatively cheaply and invest heavily in technology.
Okay. What about the traditional lenders, the building societies?
Well, the Building Societies Act 1986 allowed them to branch out too, offering unsecured loans, current accounts, things banks traditionally did. But they still have a core legal requirement.
Set 75% rule.
That's the one. A minimum of 75% of their total lending must be for residential mortgages secured on property. It keeps them focused on their original purpose.
How about some big names converted into banks?
Yes, quite a few famous building societies, Halifax, Northern Rock, Abbey National, Alliance, and Leicester, converted to become public banks in the late 80s and 90s. But many remain as building societies, often specializing purely in residential lending and avoiding riskier areas like complex commercial property loans.
What about insurance companies? Do they lend much?
Historically, they were minor players in actually providing mortgage loans, and their share has shrunk even further due to competition. They might offer some specialist products, but their main involvement now is selling insurance, life cover, buildings, and contents alongside mortgages offered by other lenders. They benefit from the mortgage process, but aren't usually the ones providing the loan capital.
Right. Now, this next category sounds interesting. Specialized mortgage companies and challenger banks. Who are these?
Okay, specialized mortgage companies emerged mainly in the late 70s and 80s. They're often set up specifically just to lend mortgages, sometimes as subsidiaries of larger groups. They're often called centralized lenders.
Right, central.
Because they typically don't have a branch network. They rely heavily on intermediaries, mortgage brokers, to bring them business. And critically, they tend to fund themselves by borrowing money in the wholesale markets, rather than taking deposits from savers like banks or building societies do.
And they often use securitization.
Very commonly, yes. They package up the mortgages they've originated and sell them on, using securitization to raise fresh cash, manage their balance sheets, and reduce the amount of regulatory capital they need to hold. The buyer gets the income. The lender often gets a fee for continuing to manage the loan administration.
And the challenger banks, are they similar?
Challenger banks are newer entrance names like Aldermore, Adam Bank, Starling Bank. They aim to disrupt the market, often using technology like apps and online-only services. They've been growing their mortgage lending quite rapidly, increasing competition for the established players.
So both these types bring innovation, but maybe carry a specific risk.
That's the trade-off. They are often very competitive on rates and introduce new product ideas. But that reliance on wholesale funding makes them potentially vulnerable. If those funding markets dry up or become very expensive, as happened in the credit crunch, their business model comes under severe pressure.
Within this intermediary-focused world, what role do mortgage packagers play?
Packagers are like specialist middlemen. They sit between the lender, especially these centralized lenders, and the broker, or sometimes the customer. They handle a lot of the administration, check documentation, and essentially package the application to meet the specific, sometimes complex, requirements of the lender.
So they streamline the process.
Exactly. It allows the lender to focus on the funding side while the packager manages the processing and distribution. They usually charge a fee for the service, maybe 1-2% of the loan, sometimes sharing that with the broker. Often they specialize in niche areas like buy-to-let or complex income cases, becoming experts at matching applications to the right lender.
Okay. Now, what about borrowers who don't fit the standard mold? That brings us to subprime and other specialist lenders.
Right. So we have borrowers who, for various reasons, can't meet the criteria of mainstream lenders. Maybe they've had credit problems in the past. Maybe they're self-employed without a long trading history. Maybe their income is irregular, or there are issues around age or residency status.
So prime lending is for standard risk borrowers.
Yes. And subprime lending, or near prime, is specifically for borrowers assessed as having a higher risk of default.
Does higher risk automatically mean they will default?
Not necessarily. Not everyone who falls outside mainstream criteria is a bad risk, but they require much more detailed specialist assessment by the lender. And to compensate for that perceived higher risk, the lender will charge a higher interest rate. This is often called setting the rate for risk.
We know the history here. The 2007 crisis was partly fueled by reckless subprime lending. What's the situation now?
Well, the subprime market shrank massively after the crisis because of stricter regulation and the higher cost of funding for these lenders. However, there's still demand from borrowers who can't access mainstream finance, so the market does exist, but operates under much tighter underwriting standards and with that clear risk-based pricing. A revival is sort of expected, but cautiously.
Are there other specialist options for people in difficult circumstances?
Yes, a couple mentioned in the guide. Sale and rent back is one where a company buys your home, usually for less than market value, and you then rent it back from them. This is regulated by the FCA now, and you must get at least a 5-year tenancy agreement. There are also specialist short-term secured loans sometimes used to help people rebuild a damaged credit history.
Got it. And buy-to-let BTL is treated as its own specialist sector, too.
Very much so. While some high street banks do offer BTL mortgages, it's often dominated by specialist lenders or dedicated divisions of larger banks, like BM Solutions, which is part of Lloyd's Banking Group, or the Mortgage Works, part of Nationwide. These often operate primarily through mortgage intermediaries.
Okay, nearly there. The final category is just other providers. Who falls under this?
This includes finance houses, which might offer secured loans, often for things like home improvements, sometimes at fixed rates for a set term. And this category also covers providers of two specific types of finance, second charge loans and bridging finance.
Okay, let's define those clearly. Second charge loan.
This is a loan secured on your property, but it ranks behind your main mortgage. The main mortgage is the first charge. If you are unable to pay and the property had to be sold, the lender with the first charge gets repaid in full first from the proceeds. The second charge lender only gets paid if there's money left over after the first charge is cleared.
So it's higher risk for the lender?
Yes, a significantly higher risk, which means the interest rates are typically much higher than for a first charge mortgage.
And bridging finance, what's that used for?
Bridging finance is essentially a short-term loan. Its main use is to bridge the gap when someone is buying a new property before they've managed to sell their existing one. It provides the funds for the purchase and is typically repaid either when the old property sells or when a standard long-term mortgage is arranged on the new property. It's a temporary solution and usually quite expensive.
Right, that covers all the different provider types. So we've journeyed from the cultural importance of owning a home in the UK through the chaos of the credit crunch and the regulatory response, looked at market drivers, and now mapped out all the different players involved in lending.
That's a good summary. We've laid down that essential groundwork from topic one, covering why things like the MMR exist, the difference between SONIA and bank rate, and who's who in the lending zoo, from building societies to specialist packagers. Remember to use this alongside your Future Trend Financial Training Made Easy guide to really cement the details.
Definitely. It's all there in the guide for you to review. So, as a final thought for you to take away and consider as you revise, given everything we've discussed about the credit crunch, the focus on risk, affordability, the MMR, how do you think regulators and government will balance things in the future? That constant tension between wanting to encourage market growth and lending versus the absolute need to protect borrowers, especially vulnerable ones involved in things like debt consolidation.
That's the perpetual balancing act, isn't it? How much risk is acceptable for growth? It's something that will always be debated. But understanding the history, the definitions, and the current rules, as laid out in the guide and discussed here, is your key to navigating it for the exam. Good luck with the studying.
This study resource is part of Future Trend support towards your mortgage qualification. Keep practicing, stay confident, and best of luck with your exams. Future Trend Financial Training. accredited CMAP learning and support provider for the LIBF.